Listen on Demand, brought to you by 680 News.
Jamie, first, thank you very much for doing this interview with me, The Secret Disco Revolution. You're, of course, the producer, writer, director. What made you decide to do a film about an era that had such highs and such lows?
Well, to be honest, I actually went to pitch a film to an arts television station at the time about Harold Pinter, the British playwright. And the broadcaster's eyes glazed over, and she said, "Nobody cares about Harold Pinter anymore. How about a film on disco?" And I said, "Okay." So that was the original inspiration. Beyond that, I knew it would be a great time to look at for a film. It was tons of great pictures, great music, you know, wretched excess, cheesy stuff galore. But then I subsequently thought I need something to sink my teeth into a little bit more to actually make it sustain for a feature-length film. And fortunately, there were a bunch of new histories coming out about the disco era at that time that were suddenly trying to reclaim it and reinterpret it as a misunderstood time of protest and liberation. So with all of this, I knew there was a bunch of great stuff to work with.
But you took a different approach to this in so many different ways. For one, you didn't just go into New York City, Studio 54, this is where it all happened. You even take it to other places in other eras, you know, right down to Germany and you know, just around with the Nazi era.
Well, I like to have Nazis in every film. You know, they do kind of furnish a movie, don't you think? Well, I was following the lead, first of all, of you know, once you plunge into, we think of the disco era as just being about, yeah, Studio 54, Saturday Night Fever, but in fact, once you start to look into it, it sort of spanned a whole decade, broadly speaking, 1970 to 1980. So I wanted to take, and there are various theories about how it had this raw, meaningful, underground purpose at first, and then became commercialized, quickly and turned into the things that we all associate with it. Some people think this is good. Some people think this is bad. Some people think all the glitz and commercialization was what disco was all about. But I was, in terms of how far back I wound up going in the history, you know, even beyond to the 40s and earlier, I was simply following the lead or investigating the theories of one of the new historians who's come out with a book claiming that the first discos were rooted in the anti-Nazi swing kids in occupied France and Germany. He makes the case that these kids dancing to, this is the first instance of people dancing to record to forbidden recorded music, and it was a subtle form of protest. So both in terms of his protest, this historian's protest argument, and also, you know, the model of kids dancing to records, he says this was the first discotheque. You know, who knows? Is he right? Is he wrong? Whoever gets to write history, I guess, has the last word.
What was it like for you, though, to get so many of these artists who exploded during that era? Because it wasn't easy to get all of them. I have to assume that.
Oh yeah, it's never easy getting celebrities of any kind, and even of the disco era is no exception. So it took a certain amount of work and digging, and had some great researchers working with me, thankfully. And it was really quite thrilling to be able. It is always kind of fun, I have to say. You know, much as I may pretend to be a deep documentary filmmaker, it is always kind of fun and interesting in one way and another to meet celebrities. And so it was interesting to be able to step back in time and see the village people sitting there and then see what they've become versus what you remember, for instance. A lot of the disco acts actually look a lot better than they did in the original, in the old footage, you know. Mysteries of time, I guess. But it was quite exciting.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that I found interesting, too, in watching some of the interviews, for example, you had Kool & the Gang. And, of course, Kool sitting there talking about the music. But, of course, I grew up, and I know they had their, you know, 70s and, you know, through the disco and dance music. But, of course, a lot of people don't realize, really, Kool & the Gang were a serious funk group. Listening to KC of KC and the Sunshine Band talk about, well, I consider myself an R&B funk artist, and suddenly I'm being labeled as a disco artist. I found that very interesting for him talking about it. I interviewed him in the past, too, and he talked about the same thing and said, I thought I was a funk artist, and people had me labeled as a disco artist. It's that conflict of what you think you are, but what you're becoming successful as.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, the film is full of all these great stars of that era. You know, Gloria Gaynor, Village People, Casey and the Sunshine Band, Kool and the Gang, et cetera, et cetera. So all the kind of goodies are in there. But the other point I think you're making quite rightly is that it's interesting, you know, subtly, that's a film full of fun and music and stars and crazy kitsch, glittery stuff. But, you know, also at the root is the question about how history gets written. And when you start talking on one hand to, you know, the historians who are writing these books, they have one version of events, and they say the era meant, you know, was a time of protest and liberation. You go back to the artists themselves, they're not even calling themselves disco. They can't even agree on that much. Exactly. Kool and the Gang, as you said, in fact, started as a jazz band before becoming a funk band, before becoming disco. In some ways, you could see them as much more authentic than what is considered disco. In another way, you could see them as the epitome of the disco era because they were so ready to transform themselves to be commercially viable. In fact, their song Jungle Boogie originally resulted out of a session in which the record company wanted them to do a cover of an African song called Soul Makossa, which was actually considered the first disco dance floor hit, the first song to become a hit off the dance floor as opposed to off the radio. And they were, Kool and the Gang were initially meant to go in and cover this, and then they thought, you know, the heck with this. We don't have to cover some other song. We'll come up with our own thing. So Jungle Boogie is their version of an African funk song. Anyway, yeah, it's a bunch of interesting stuff. And actually, I have to say, I found KC to be one of the crankiest interviews in the film, which is mysterious to me, given how well he must be doing, having, unlike many of the disco artists who are just one-hit wonder singers brought in to sing other people's songs and hence don't enjoy the royalties of their work. KC wrote a lot of hits himself, so he must be doing pretty well, I reckon. Why he should be so cranky and bitter about the whole era, I'm not entirely sure. You know, he had a song on the most successful selling record of all time, the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. I want to get a T-shirt made for him that says Disco Sulks.
No, I got to say, because KC is one of my favorite bands. He's
Me
one
too.
Of my favorite songwriters.
He is my favorite of that era. I mean, I love his music. He's just not a happy camper.
Same here. And I'll tell you something. I found the same thing when I talked to him. It was just this sort of like blah kind of thing. It's like, dude, at least you're still touring.
And his songs are so sunny
exactly.
and fun, right? They're called the Sunshine Band, and you couldn't describe him as Mr. Sunshine anymore.
No. And it's too bad. The other thing I found very interesting about your film was if you really put everything together, disco should never have made it. It had so many hurdles to jump over to make it. I mean, because it was stereotyped, it was underground, it was, you know, just trying to get songs on the radio. I mean, everything was a backlash, but somehow at a certain point in time in this time period, it became one of the biggest things. A point I love when how you put in that all you had to do was put on a record. The songs could suck, but as long as you put on disco, it was going to be a major hit.
If you put the name disco on the label, that's right. The one of the VPs of Casablanca Records, Larry Harris, makes that point in the film. It just got... I mean, really, that is as much as anything what I see. You've put your finger on it again. I mean, what I see as perhaps one of, if not the deeper meaning of the meanings of the era was, it was a really interesting time business-wise, because it seems like there have been a number of pop music, of pop phenomena that started as underground movements and then, you know, have gradually become commercialized. You know, look at how alternative music went from being something alternative to just being a different, you know, market category. I suspect that kind of that market sophistication was something that really developed, was really fine-tuned and honed and really exploded in the disco era. They found, as you say, an era that was operating completely contrary to the existing business model of the music business at the time, which is that hits were made by radio play. And they came up through the clubs, and suddenly, you know, the market woke up to the fact that, yeah, this music, you know, made by black people that was popular among gay people, and was coming up in the clubs could also make them money. And they just turned that into a big sausage factory. Now, whether, you know, this has musical merit or was inadvertently revolutionary, I'll leave to, you know, more qualified historians to say.
Well, I think it's really interesting. Plus, I think the timing for this movie is perfect. Of course, losing Donna Summers earlier this year, I think.
Yes, and Robin Gibb.
And Robin Gibb, too. How do you feel about the fact that we've had two disco icons leave us and now presenting this movie in the way you guys have done it? I mean, again, I think perfect timing.
Yes, well, I assure you I didn't kill them just for the sake of the release of the film, and I don't want to, you know, sound too happy about anybody dying, but I mean, it is, you know, from a movie release point of view, I think interesting timing at the very least that we have a whole new slant on what their meaning was, and of course, you know, they're no longer around to pronounce one way or another, but I think people will be interested in what comes up in the film for sure.
What do you think about what do you think we're going to learn from this film in this era? At a time where so much conflict was going on, you know, the ending of the Vietnam War, and you know, nobody having two pennies to rub together. Gas prices are up. There's racial tension, but you know, for some strange reason, in these small basement clubs, black, white, gay, whatever, seem to somehow come together and have a good time in this their own little world.
I mean, I think when I tell people that about the basic theory that is the jumping off point of this film, that disco was nobody realized disco was in fact a time of revolution. People's reaction, as mine was at first, was huh, often followed by a bit of laughter, and then well, maybe there's something to that. And that kind of reflects my own experience with the film, and I think and hope what the audience will get from it as well. Now, I mean, I approach it playfully. I think, you know, there is a certain internal language that academics like to use, and sometimes, you know, it may have more to do with themselves than anything that we could, you know, qualify as real. But I think the wonderful thing about looking at all this with the disco era is, you know, it's disco, for God's sake. It's a lot of fun no matter what. And I think there's some unanswered questions in some of these newfangled theories, like saying disco was a time of protest and all of that. Well, gee, wasn't there a lot of anti-Vietnam protest right before? And wasn't there something called the civil rights movement before, and a lot of songs that went along with that too? And wasn't even gay protest sort of culminating in and around the Stonewall riots of 1969 in New York? You know, it's perhaps a little, it's conveniently ignoring certain historical context, I guess, to look at this decade of disco in isolation. I mean, this is my own take on some of these theories. Not that I'm dismissing them altogether, but, you know, this is not the first time the world or New York or pop culture ever heard of spontaneous protest and culture coming together. In any case, I think, agree with it or disagree with it, there's a lot to chew on in this film and a lot to dance to.
There you go. There you go. You said it. A lot to dance to. Absolutely. And one of the things that I'm really, really happy about is that, yeah, you kick in some tracks that I think people have either completely forgotten about or they're going, well, what is that? And I think that's the thing I really enjoy about watching this, because I'm sitting there going, oh, my God, I forgot about this song. Oh, geez.
It's great, isn't it? No, it's wonderful. Look, I was a music critic first, way back, so at the base of all this, you know, theorizing, I just want to get the good music in there, too.
Any chance that you might want to do a follow-up? And, of course, it wouldn't be disco, but it could be, you know, music from the 80s. It could be the punk era. It could be any of that.
I think there's all sorts of things, you know, that one could do with this approach. I actually have the next film I have lined up is in fact about Jewish humor, which may not seem like the most natural segue to disco, but I did tell you I like to get Hitler in every film just for fun. But in a similar kind of way, I think it's a topic that a broad topic that people think they know a lot about, but once you start to dig into, there's all sorts of surprises. And I think this idea for me of mixing kind of popular culture, popular entertainment, and different unexpected twists on the past and present of it is certainly something I want to do more of.
Well, I am a huge fan of this one. I cannot wait to see your next film. But, I think folks are really going to get a great kick out of this. And especially, I don't want to give too much away, but You got three people who are helping us go through the whole film. I think it's fantastic. In fact, it was one point I was thinking to myself, is this some kind of thing like a disco version of, I don't know, some documentary wacko thingamajig or whatever? What's this?
Oh, the Masterminds device.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Well, there is a, yes. Thank you for hinting at it and being subtle. I think we can safely say I use a pretty unconventional storytelling device in this thing. In fact, if we were being more less diplomatic, we could just say it's kind of cheesy and completely over the top. I take a tone. I found it kind of an interesting challenge for a documentary. Usually documentaries just, they have their main speaker, their main authority figure, and then that person voices, they're like the voice of God, and they tell us what's really been going on in this, you know, war-torn zone or whatever. And what I wanted to do was engage and challenge and kind of have a dialogue with some of my academic theories in this while telling the story. You know, just as I say, following my own first reaction to the theories that disco was secretly a revolution, just kind of go, really? And it's actually a harder thing to do from a filmmaking point of view than you might think, because if you undercut your expert, then why should your audience listen to them? So what I ultimately found was taking a more kind of playful, ironic approach, and we got Peter Kelligan, the wonderful comic actor, to do the narration, and the tone of it is sort of like, at last it can be told. There was a secret disco revolution, so secret that the participants themselves were unaware of it. And it kind of plays on a bit like a kind of playful faux history. Well, the next logical step in that thinking process is, well, if it was so secret that the participants didn't know about it, then obviously it would have required, you know, masterminds puppeteering all these events and creating a $4 billion industry. So I decided to, you know, speculatively create the world of who these masterminds might be. And what I did was that you could call them reenactments, or you could call them complete fiction, or you could just call them this cheesy Mod Squad-like disco trio of characters who kind of drift above the documentary action, a little bit unconventional, we might say, for a doc, kind of, as I say, like a glittery, cheesy Mod Squad puppeteering all the historical events. And it's just kind of a playful way of engaging with some of these newfangled theories. And, you know, cheesy, over-the-top disco kind of seemed to work.
I thought it was more like a disco Trailer Park Boys kind of thing for a second. I was just like, what is this? And then I got it.
The audience bring their own references to it. I don't want to impose, you know, anything on you.
Seriously.
That's fine with me. Disco Trailer Parks works for me.
Seriously, congratulations. Great film. Really,
thank
really
you.
Enjoyed it and cannot wait to see your next one. But this one, what a stand. I hope a lot of folks go out and check this out, because this just puts that whole documentary disco era thing, it takes it to a completely different level. I want to see somebody try to top you on this one, because I think it's going to be very hard to do.
Thank you so much, Rudy. Thank you for having me on. Been a pleasure. Thanks
again. Take care.
Okay, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.